Thank you for that. I appreciate it. That's a really a moving song. Is that modern? How old is that? Oh, well, I should have known that. It was just too wonderful to be modern. And anyway, great. I appreciate that. And I think I got some of the timing down. I don't know. I was having some difficulty skipping and missing some of those words. Thank you for that. You don't know who wrote it, huh? Do you remember who wrote it? Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. Light is his last name? Okay. Light. We're back to the Acts chapter 22. And so we're kind of bounding through this chapter quicker than I usually bound through chapters. But a lot of this is narrative. And so I have a real dilemma as I look forward to preaching the chapters when Paul makes his second defense, because he uses the same thing. And so I don't know, I might just preach the same thing back again. Well, if the Bible repeats it, I mean, why shouldn't I repeat it, right? And so Paul, it's kind of interesting, even the way that the Acts is broken up here, that at the end of chapter 21, it just leaves, you know, it leaves you hanging. Now, it reminds me of what they told me in seminary, how the Bible was broken up into chapters and verses, that a guy actually was riding the horse as he was doing this, and then sometime the horse would stumble and he'd put a period probably where it shouldn't one be. Well, anyway, they try to break this up. Obviously, it's in chapters and verses so we can reference these things more easily. It didn't come to us in chapters and verses, but surely it's a wonderful thing that it has been broken up this way for us so we can go there. But you'll remember that this chapter begins with Paul's defense, and that his defense before that these Asian Jews that have stirred up the crowd, and now all of the crowd is stirred up, and Paul had to be rescued by the chief captain, or he would have been stomped to death right there in the temple. Now, isn't that interesting? That these Jews who love the temple and who, you know, who references the temple and treats it as a sacred place would have stomped the Apostle Paul to death if the chief captain had not come. Well, now, so he gives him a chance, and Paul begins to speak in the Hebrew tongue. And when they heard it was in the Hebrew tongue, they listened. They were more silent. And he told them, he said, you know, about what he was. Basically, he gives a testimony. He doesn't give the gospel in some kind of abstract way. He doesn't just preach or speak an undetached message or an undetached, references, or at least undetached to truths of the gospel, but he's speaking it as he has experienced it. And so his defense, even as our defense should be, is this experienced gospel. He's experienced it. And then my good friend R.F. Gates, who taught evangelism, he was a true evangelist, I mean, in the sense that he gave himself to itinerant preaching, and he gave himself to the preaching of the Word of God and through gospel preaching, one of the most magnificent preachers that I've ever heard, probably a little bit unorthodox in the sense that his style probably would never be able to be replicated or taught, but when he began to speak, and when God was with him when God has anointed him. Some of the greatest preaching I've ever heard. And so when he taught, he said, well, your testimony needs to have three elements. And he used just three words, then, when, and now. What were you then? When did that change? And what are you now? And that's exactly what Paul does. So he says, you know, I'm a man. I was born a Jew in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia. I didn't stay there long, but I came to Jerusalem and sat under the feet of Gamaliel. And I persecuted this way unto death. And I went and I captured them and I bound them and delivered them into prisons, both men and women. And also, you can go talk to the high priest and to those that are around him. They would confess that they gave me letters. And when I was going to Damascus to bring them which were in this way, I was going to bind them and I was going to bring them to Jerusalem for to punish them. But I never got to do that. Because as I was going to Damascus, this great light shone from heaven, brighter than the noonday sun. And I fell to the ground because of the great intensity of what was happening to me. And then I heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? I didn't know who he was, but I knew he was a Lord, because no one could do this except a Lord. Who art thou, Lord? And then I heard, can you imagine the Apostle Paul when he heard who it was? Then I heard him say, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest. And they that were with me didn't hear that voice. They saw a light. Later he'll say some thought they heard it thunder. But they were afraid. And I said, well, what do you want me to do, Lord? And the Lord said unto me, arise, go into Damascus, and there it shall be told thee. Now, the Lord himself didn't tell him, you see. He told him to go find a man. That's the way God works. We shouldn't think that thing strange. We shouldn't think it strange that the Apostle Paul, under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, would say, by the foolishness of preaching, it's pleased God to save them that believe. There's something supernatural about true preaching. There's nothing supernatural about giving a lecture. There's nothing supernatural about standing in cold indifference, rehearsing biblical truths. But there's surely something about a gifted and anointed preacher called by God, as it were, separated from his mother's womb, to stand and preach. So the Lord himself, just like the angel told Cornelius, go find Peter, the Lord himself said, you go to Damascus, and there'll be one there, and he'll tell you what you must do. And one Ananias, a devout man, he lived by the law of God, by the moral law of God, and all the Jews knew it. And he had a great report of all the Jews. He came unto me, and he stood, and he said, Brother Saul, receive thy sight. In the same hour I looked upon him, and then he said, The God of our fathers hath chosen thee. I've often heard it said that God's looking for those who are willing. Paul was not willing. Paul was an enemy of God. Paul was on a course to destroy those that believed this way. He went with great religious zeal to punish those that he believed with all of his heart was blaspheming God and going against God. But in reality, it was Paul himself that was doing that. Oh, wretched creatures that we are by nature. You're chosen. And you'll notice he didn't ask Paul's permission. He didn't beg him, said, Well, now if you'll be willing, we'll send you. No, no. In the day of thy power, thy people shall be willing. So Paul never questioned it. You're chosen of God, our Father, the God of our fathers, that thou shouldest know his will and see that just one and shouldest hear the voice of his mouth. I say, you see the three things there. Number one, you will know God's will. You will know the truth about God. You'll know about his person. You will know about his purpose. And then you'll see this just one. You'll see Christ as he is presented in the gospel. And you'll hear the voice of the Spirit. It's not going to be your words. It's going to be his words. And it's going to be about Christ. And it's going to be in the power of the Spirit. For we did not come to you with enticing words of man's wisdom, Paul wrote to the church at Corinth. But in the power and the demonstration of the Spirit of God, that your faith be not put in man, but in God. And you're going to be a witness unto all men. Now we see that the word all men here cannot mean every individual man that ever was or ever will be, but all men in the sense of all types of men. In other words, you're going to the Gentiles. And you're going to tell them, you're going to be a witness of what you have seen and heard. And that's what it is. I mean, faith can be summed up in two words, seen and heard. What have you seen? Where we see the image of Christ, not with the eyes of the flesh, but with the eyes of faith. We see him, you see, as he is presented in the word, and we agree. And it's like we know him, you see. It's like we've always known him. He's no stranger to us. And then he speaks. The Spirit speaks, you see, through the word of God. You see, you're going to know his will. You're going to see the just one. And you're going to hear his voice. And that's not only Paul, but that's all of us in our testimony in becoming a Christian. Every one of us We have known his will, we have seen the just one, and we hear his voice. And so much more the preacher, you see. This is all we have. The gospel is all we have. Preachers don't like that, and the reason I know that is because so many preachers over the years and over the centuries have tried to fish out other things and preach other things and show their cleverness in philosophy or in other scientific endeavors or whatever, but all we have, there's no life in philosophy. There's no life in scientific discoveries. There's only life in this gospel. And you're going to be a witness. Now, why are you waiting? Be baptized and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord. You see, it's not the baptism that saved him. It's not the water that he got in that washed away his sin. It is the calling upon the name of the Lord. There has to be a reality behind the baptism, or it's not biblical, it's not gospel, it's not evangelical baptism. It's just simply getting in water. You see, but this has a reality behind it, because we are not saved by the works of righteousness, but we are saved by the washing of regeneration, you see, by the word. And it came to pass that when I was come again to Jerusalem, even while I prayed in the temple, I was in a trance and saw him saying unto me, didn't say who he saw, he just said him. We understand that the antecedent of that is Christ. And I saw him stand, saying unto me, make haste, get thee quickly out of Jerusalem, for they will not receive thy testimony concerning me. And I said, Lord, they know I've been imprisoned and beaten in every synagogue, them that believe on thee. And when the blood of thy martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by. And really the word martyr here is just simply the translation of the word witness. And when the blood of thy witness, in fact, witnesses were killed so often in the early church that actually the word to witness gave us the word martyr, one who died. And I was consenting unto his death. And I kept their clothes as they slew him. And he said unto me, depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the Gentiles. Verse 22, and those that were hearing, they gave him audience. They gave audience unto his word. And then lifted up their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for it is not fit that he should live. And as they cried out and cast off their clothes and threw dust into the air, And can you imagine a thousand or so people standing before him going crazy, crying, screaming, ripping their clothes, throwing dirt in the air. The chief captain, who was standing near, commanded him to be brought into the castle and bade that he should be examined by scourging. In other words, they were going to beat the truth out of him, that he might know wherefore they cried so against him. What has this man done? Surely he could not just have done what he said he'd done. There has to be more to this. Why would they want to destroy him? So beat him until he tells you, because I want to know. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said unto the centurion that stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man that is a Roman and uncondemned? When the centurion heard that, he went and told the chief captain, saying, take heed what thou doest. For this man is a Roman. Then the chief captain came and said, tell me, art thou a Roman? And he said, yea. And the chief captain answered, with a great sum obtained I this freedom. And Paul said, but I was, King James puts the word free, but literally he says, I was born a Roman. Which made him a greater Roman, you see. Then straightway they departed from him, which should have examined him. And the chief captain also was afraid after he knew that he was a Roman. And because he had bound him. On the morrow, because he would have known the certainty whereof he was accused of the Jews, he loosed him from his bands and commanded the chief priest and all their council to appear, and brought Paul down and set him before them. Now this kind of ends like the 21st chapter ends. It ends with you kind of hanging. And then Paul now is going to speak to the council. Now, what do we see in this text? Well, the first thing we see that they indeed gave him audience because these were prejudiced people. Now, you want to see prejudice. I mean, you know, they call it racism. Everything's called racism now. There's not even such, there's only one race. There's other things, the invention of men. It's the invention of anthropologists, all these different races. There's one race. There's the race of Adam. And that's all there is. But there is great prejudice in the world. And you have never seen prejudice until you've seen prejudice from the Jews concerning the Gentiles. I can tell you that the Gentiles were considered scum. to such a degree that even when they would have were coming to Pilate to have an audience with him to kill Christ, because it was the Sabbath day, they wouldn't even enter into his house, because he was this man Pilate, this man who was the governor of the Roman governor of the whole area, and that included Jerusalem. These people were so arrogant against him, they wouldn't even go in, because they were not worthy to have a Jew in their house on the Sabbath day. So when they saw Paul speaking in Hebrew, immediately their prejudice was somewhat subsided. But it didn't take long. You see, it's never the thing they say it is. It's never the thing that they claim it is. There's always something behind this thing, you see. And it didn't matter how much explanation Paul would have given them, how much he would have appealed to the power of God, because there were many of them in the council that didn't even believe in the power of God. And we'll see that in the next chapter. The Sadducees and the Pharisees, they were at odds with one another. The Sadducees only believed that this life was it. And so tradition, much like if you've ever known the Fiddler on the Roof, it was tradition. You know, the tradition is just simply that which keeps everyone balanced. They didn't believe in the resurrection. But the Pharisees did, you see. So they would have at least, in fact, Paul's going to use that division for his favor in the next chapter. But the point is, it didn't matter what he told them. They were convinced, and they were not leaving that place until they killed him. So they lifted up their voice, and you see the next thing they did? They lost their reason. Is it a reasonable response that you don't agree with someone or you think someone is guilty? Is it a reasonable response to grab your own clothes and rip them off? Is it a reasonable response to take dirt in your hands and throw dirt up in there? You see, that was the response they did for Christ, you see. They lost their minds. It reminds me of a statement by Rolf Barnard, the great Texas evangelist who died in 1973 in Gonzales, Louisiana. Rolf Barnard was one of the few men preaching the gospel when almost no men preached the gospel. And here's what Barnard said. A lost man is a madman. He's crazy. When it comes to God, he's lost all reason. And if you do not agree with them, it drives them mad. I can tell you this is the common characteristic of all false religion. They will not listen. They will not be reasoned with. That's why it's almost, you know, without purpose to even try to defend yourself. In fact, the Lord said in this great Sermon on the Mount, the Lord told us that we shouldn't cast our pearls before swine, lest they turn and rend thee. So they're throwing dirt in the air, they're screaming, they're tearing their clothes off to such a degree that the chief captain runs and said, listen, there's got to be something more than simply that testimony I heard. But it was nothing more than that. So we see he comes in and he rescues Paul. This man who was not a Jew. This man who was a Roman had to come in and protect Paul from his own people. So now this is very interesting how the story turns. I'm going to beat it out of him. We've got to beat this out of him until he tells us the truth. So he orders the centurion. Which, you know, obviously comes from the fact that they were, you know, one of 100. Beat the centurion. Or tell the centurion to beat Paul until he admitted what was wrong. But we see what Paul does. He appealed to his Roman citizenship. Now, we've read this all our lives. It probably wouldn't surprise us. But it is kind of surprising that he would appeal to Rome. He is appealing now to Rome to save him. And he knows that Rome is an enemy. In fact, it'll be the Roman government that puts him to death. But it is Rome that is an enemy of these things. And yet, Paul uses what the Lord in his providence has given him. And I think that probably says something to us about the fact that we are an American. I know that there's other countries in North America and South America that kind of resents us using the word American, but I don't know what other word we could use. I mean, we're not a United Statesian, so we have to say we're American. There was nothing, obviously, Rome gave us an understanding. I mean, Rome is in itself pagan. Paganism comes from Rome. It was the religion of Rome, and it was not an insult. It was just simply the delineation of what they were. They were pagan. They were not Christian. And there was no nation, no empire in all the world before or since that is as pagan as Rome. And yet Paul appealed to the pagan empire of Rome. Because in the providence of God, he was born a Roman. In the providence of God, we have this great citizenship in America. And we should use that. See, Paul didn't use that per se to advantage himself, but to protect this gospel, to protect his witness, you see, because the Lord has already told him that he was going to Rome. The apostle knew these things, you see. And so he's using, which tells us another thing, you see, that we, and this will be a point later in the next chapter, but that we ought to use any means available to us to do the will of God. That we don't need to be an American citizen like some American citizens that are arrogant and proud and boastful. Christians don't wear those things well. We ought to thank God for the United States of America. And we ought to thank God that we've been given citizenship in the greatest country in the history of the world. Not anything we bought, not anything we did, but something he gave us. And we should use the citizenship to his glory. I know there's been a lot of talk about Christian nationalism and all that. You know what Christian nationalism is? What Christian nationalism is Christians standing up to live out their creed, Jesus Christ is Lord. That's all it is. I don't know if you heard the other day, but one, I can't remember her name, but one of these talking heads on MSNBC or NBC, one of them, she said, well, I can tell you what Christian nationalists are. Christian nationalists are these people that believe their rights doesn't come from the Constitution, but that their rights come from God. Guilty. Guilty. That's all we are. You see, people don't mind you living your Christianity. As long as you're quiet within these walls. They do not want us in the marketplace. They haven't wanted us in the marketplace for most of my life. They don't want us out there discussing our ideas with their ideas. And you see, there was a long time in the United States of America that those who were against Christianity and those who were more liberal would at least listen, would at least allow someone to talk, but not anymore. They won't even allow you to talk. And this is the natural result of it. They want to shout you down. Anything seem familiar to you? There's no difference, you see. What these people are doing to Paul is what they are doing to us. They become unreasonable. They throw dirt in the air, as it was. They don't want to hear us. But isn't it interesting what the apostle appealed to? When it looked like he was going to lose his life. And now they're the very ones who were going to save him are now talking about beating him. And the apostle used what the Lord had given him. Even as we should. Now isn't it interesting that now the chief captain's afraid of Paul. And now he's fearful that he's gone too far. So he loosed him. And now he is commanding. See, they commanded Paul to be killed. But now the chief captain is commanding the priest, the chief priest, and the council. To come to him, they must appear before him. From the beginning, the Jews would not hear Paul. He had to escape for his life. At the end here, in the next chapter, we'll see Paul is going to have to escape for his life. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem. The Lord cried over Jerusalem. How oft would I have gathered you together as a hen does her chicks. But they would not. And somewhere about 35 years from Paul standing here, the Roman army is going to march into Jerusalem and destroy it. Because they did not know the day of their visitation. And so roughly, this is what the first half of the book of Revelation, when it gets into the actual prophecy, the first half up to about the 13th chapter, is going to be a description. It's a prophecy that John is giving, a description of this destruction. Because they did not receive him. Oh, what a wonderful thing the Lord has done for us. To open our hearts and to transform us from enemies of Christ to children of God. Let's pray.